If you would join me in prayer, and then I'll tell you where we're going, and then we'll go there. Lord God, we thank you for this time, and we ask that you would grant us wisdom, grant us thinking, grant us just clarity on what often and too often is a confusing topic. We pray that you would help us to be wise as you have called us to be. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Again, just kind of to kind of recap where we've been and where we're going. The premise of the series is just kind of looking at those issues that so often get put on autopilot until something goes very wrong, and then there's damage done, or it's too late, or it takes way more work later to fix something that's an easy fix today. More so than most is tonight's topic, except no, they're all about the same in this. If you put any one of these on autopilot for too long, the pieces are very, very difficult, if not impossible at times, to pick up. And so and finances is no different. Interestingly, week one of the things we spent a lot of time talking about is just the stewardship of being a person. How do I manage my body well? How do I manage my mental state well, my spiritual state well, my health well, and those pieces, heart, mind, soul, strength? How do I steward those well and manage those well because they're God's? Then we did something else. We did marriage last week. We kind of come back to this topic of stewardship in a different way this week, and then the last week will kind of link back to the marriage. So there's kind of a nice symmetry of this whole class, which was unintentional, but that's how this is working. Tonight we're talking about a healthier outlook and finances and that kind of stuff. So just disclaimers on the front end, the legal part of this is not financial advice. I am not a financial whatever. The law hasn't been put into place yet, but there's a fiduciary law coming, and it says I'm allowed to give general education. I am not allowed to tell you to buy this or that stock or not or anything like that. So these are things everyone should know, but not financial advice, which is ironic that sounds, that's just how that works. Some of this tonight will be very, very basic, but I find none of this stuff is taught anymore, or it's rare. I had a teacher in eighth grade who was bored with the social studies curriculum, and therefore, like, when he finished that, he did a section on money and how to write a check and how to balance a checkbook. It wasn't part of the curriculum. He just liked that stuff and jammed it in there. But unless you have a teacher like that, you've never learned. Like, they don't, unless your parents taught you, or you had a strange teacher, this isn't taught anymore. And therefore, it often is a problem. Often people make dumb decisions. Even the smartest, savviest, shrewdest money people I know still often make dumb money mistakes because of neglect and laziness. And because there's something about you work on it. When you work on it all day long, you don't want to do it when you get home. So you may be, spend all your day with numbers, and then you get home and you're like, I don't want to look at a spreadsheet. It's an ironic twist of that. I often worry that because I spend all day thinking or studying or trying to get ready for sermons and God things, when I get home, when the food's on the table, I might, let's not say grace, let's just eat, because come on now. I'm not the one to push for those things, because it's my job all day to push for that, and I don't want to do it when I get home. I think the same happens a lot of times with even people who know a lot about money. When they finally are looking at their own life, they kind of say, whatever, I'll just put it on autopilot. My hope for this class is that you are bored to tears and you say, I know everything he was saying, and I've done more than everything he's saying, and so we're totally good. That's my hope. My expectation is, at the bare minimum, I'm going to give you a couple things to think about and check up on and probably talk about. And my hunch is that you will find at least one or two areas that you are decently, if not totally, deficient. And we should spend some time fixing that or doing something about that. One of the other things I want to just kind of say up front, I have a living example happening at the moment of sometimes the interesting thing about finances and this kind of outlook in general is sometimes slow and simple and safe really does win the race. Oftentimes, slow and simple and safe really does beat out fast and fun and complex and risky. Over time, and I'm actually, I don't know that I'm allowed to say this, but I'm actually kind of living this out and watching my parents. My mom's a pastor. She does not make all that much money, but she saves it and she lives below her means, and she at the moment is she's worried about it, but she's in a very good financial state. My dad he was a banker and a lawyer, and he's made lots of money, and he's lost lots of money, and he's made some investing and done this and done that, and he's the way more savvy financial person of those two. And if my dad was broke, it wouldn't shock me. So it's this funny just picture of sometimes slow and steady really does win the race. So therefore, knowing what these slow, simple, and safe rules are becomes really important. The other thing, just because I don't know that I say it anywhere else, one of the strange things about money is putting things in place and leaving them-ish for long amounts of time does really, can do exponentially better things than not. And I'll give you some examples of that later, but that's just going to be, it's an accounting thing in general, but if you're earning 10% on certain amount of money, you don't need that much money for that to become millions of dollars 40, 50, 60 years from now, if it just stays there. And again, I'll give you some examples of that a little bit later. But first, we're just going to kind of, the way this class is going to be structured is we're going to talk about how we view money, how God views money, and kind of keep it at the 30,000 foot view for the first, let's say, half of the class. Then the last half of the class is, these are some steps you should be taking if you have not already. And we're going to get kind of very nitty gritty. And that's what the whole second packet is, just got things to help you work on different parts. So, and in my head, I think when I originally was trying to think through this class, I was like, and man, what would be great is then I could give them like 30 minutes to an hour and they could just sit with all their finances and just kind of work through it. I'm not going to give you any time because I would have told you you had to bring all your finances, and that was, it would have been difficult for most people. So that's what the second packet is. You take that home and then you you realize, hey, we just need to work on the first page and then we're done. Or, hey, we need to work on all of these pages. Or we have page 5 done and page 7 done, but we need to work on some of these other ones. And so the packet is really the take-home homework for you, the second packet. So first, kind of over, any questions? Are we good? All right, beautiful. How people view money. Some of the common views of money. A lot of people will either come in two camps. One is money is very, very evil, or money is very, very good. Interestingly, the Bible doesn't say money is evil. The Bible says, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Money can be bad. The love of money can absolutely be bad. But money itself is money. It's a medium. If you go back all the way to where money began, it was a system of barter. I grew grain and you grew something else, and I'll give you some bread if you give me some apples, and we trade. And at some point that becomes kind of a pain to move all that grain around. So instead of taking home that many apples at once, we started a currency, and money is trade. Money is that value. It's why we care so much about money. Is in some ways, it's not just paper, it's not just coins. This is the manifestation of my work. I spent lots of time, blood, sweat, tears, stress, and all the rest, and they gave me these dollars. So somehow all of that work translated into these dollars. So it's not just, it's just money. It's just dirty. Like, it's not. It's all of my work manifest into dollars. And so how we work with it and what we do with it is important. One of the common misconceptions or views is money leads to happiness. There was a study done that basically said it leans toward happiness, or it helps toward happiness until you collectively as a family are making somewhere around $70,000-ish, depending on where you live and adjusted for inflation and some other things. But after that, it doesn't actually lead to any amount of extra happiness at all. And frankly, starts going the other way a little bit. But somewhere around the 70 is what you sort of need to, like, then you're not worried that you're not eating and you have some kind of shelter that you're living in. After that, it actually doesn't bring any extra happiness at all. Ecclesiastes has a lot in money. Whoever loves money never has enough money. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. One of the things earlier in Ecclesiastes, the assumption is, It's Solomon, the wisest man ever, and at some point, it's chapter 2 or 3, somewhere in Ecclesiastes, he basically says, he kind of put this money leads to happiness thing to the test. He's like, I had all the money I needed in the world, so I just started doing things that I thought would make me, I just started spending money to make me happy. Turns out I didn't get happy, not at all. And it turns out that's not actually a logical, money doesn't lead to happiness. And the reason I know, I tried. It doesn't. And so Ecclesiastes has a lot to say about money for that reason. A lot of times the reason we want money is because we want security or we want sufficiency or we want status. The assumption being that if I have more money, I'll be safer. If something happens to me, I will be able to pay my medical bills. I'll be able to... And all these... There's a little bit of truth here. And not. Money will give you a little bit more security. It won't make you secure. Because no matter how much money you have, you still can get hit by a bus. Tragedies still happen. Sometimes weird things happen and your body just stops. Money won't stop that. So it can make you more secure. It can't give you security. Sometimes we want money because we want to be sufficient. I want enough. And there's kind of this craving for money because then I'll have enough. And except enough's always a moving target. It's one of those funny, other than a very, very select few of people, no one assumes like, no. If I told you that this coming Sunday was a sermon on greed, that will be one of the lowest attended because no one here is greedy. That's ridiculous. Because we know greedy people. They're the ones who have more than we do. Even though that's not actually part of the definition. It actually doesn't matter how much money you have to be greedy. No one considers themselves wealthy unless you're kind of the Warren Buffetts and Bill Gates of the world. But other than a very select few, no one considers themselves truly, I have too much money. I'm just wealthy beyond compare. And therefore, sufficiency is always part of why we want more money. I want to be sufficient. And status is the other one, another one where if I have enough money, then I'll be important. Then I'll be someone. Then I'll have the right car. I'll have the right house. I'll have the right clothes. I'll be the right kind of person. We see it all the time, this area in particular, and there's others in the United States like it, where I would put money on the fact that there's a handful of houses that are very, very nice in this area that have a wonderful outside and they have a really nice entryway and there's just rooms that are absolutely empty because they can't afford to put stuff in it. Or they have a very big house and they are having serious troubles paying the bills. But we want status. I'm important if my house is awesome or my car is awesome. And never mind the fact that there's nothing in my house because I actually can't pay the bills right now. So we kind of tell ourselves sometimes that money will bring us status, and it doesn't. I'm going to refer you to different things in the other packet. But page 2, 3... though it says 15, so you're just going to have to, it's something that we do with, I do with premarital counseling, but basically what it is you answer these questions, and then it's going to spit out at the end when you do all the adding, do you see money as status, do you see it as security, do you see it as a means of enjoyment, or do you see it as a means of control, and just kind of looking at, kind of where do you lean when you think of money? So a fun little exercise, not for right now, for you to do later, but trying to get to that question of how do I see, why do I need more money? Why do I want money? And that kind of gets you at some of those. Some of the common problems with money. Why are we talking about this? Why is this so important? One of the challenges I think that we face with money and finances in general is we live with no margin. And if you live with no margin, you have stress. According to a 2013 survey released by Bankrate.com, roughly 76% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, which means for 76% of Americans, if something happens to their car, if something happens medically, if something happens to their house, they have to go into debt or take out a loan or borrow money or something like that because they literally are taking all the money that goes in and putting it all out somewhere else. So in this room, that's all of them. Like is the percentage. That's what we're talking about. 62% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings. So that's the number in the bank account. Less than that. 26% of Americans who have no savings at all. Typical household, and I got these from all over the place. So if you're actually doing the math, these are all different years and all the rest. It may not totally add up, but give or take, I think these are probably pretty accurate. Typical household debt totals more than $38,000. So you're living paycheck to paycheck. You have $38,000 in debt, and you know, you can add up some of these problems, and this is huge. A second reason why this is important and why we're talking about it, debt hurts families. Bad finances hurt families. 56% of all divorces are the result of financial pressures. Just the stress of it, just the, I want to do this with my money, you want to do this. Money is one of those things. I hope this is going the other way, but I don't think it is. We don't talk about money. We don't talk about it at home. We don't talk in front of our children. So we teach, don't talk about money. We don't ask, how much do you make? How much do you not make? How much are you in debt? We don't talk about any of that. And so, therefore, you have a husband and a wife who have never talked about money, or it's my job to do money, or it's your job to do money, but we never sit down together and talk about it. And it leads to divorce, often. And then there are larger heart issues as well. In some ways, money is a barometer of what's happening. Money problems are normally not the real problem, but instead are only the symptoms of a personal shortfall. Oftentimes, we will use our money to try and cover up something else that I'm stressed, so I'll eat or I'll shop or I'll spend to feel better. And it works, except then I'm more stressed. Because now I'm in more debt, so I need to spend more, and the vicious cycle goes on. And sometimes there's something else that's at the root that we need to kind of get at. Some common traps. We live beyond our means more often than not. One of the, I think, biggest challenges of the day is because of TV and more than TV, social media, I think is one of the most dangerous things when it comes to finances. Because it's one thing, I can watch TV and see rich people doing things and be like, I'd love a yacht, but that's never gonna happen. And I can walk away with that being like, okay, like that's not a temptation for me. But when I can see my peers and someone just went on an awesome vacation, I think to myself, we should go on a vacation. And someone else just brought a brand new car. And I'm like, we should buy a brand new. And someone else just had something else. And when I compare someone just upgraded some other aspect of their life. And when I can see all of them, I don't think, well, let's see how that budget plays out. And which one of those do I do? I think we should go on vacation and buy a new car and upgrade our house. That's what we should do. And the reason why is because everyone else is doing it. I have proof. It's on Facebook. Whereas for all you know, some of those folks have been saving for years to do some of those things. But we see that they bought a thing and they went on a thing and that they spent money over there. So we should do all of them. And so that idea of comparison, we'll talk about that again in a minute. One of the challenges is simply just that feeling that we don't have enough stuff. Which is only slightly ironic because we spend $12 billion for someone else to store our extra stuff. There's a new storage place going in Keller. Thank God, because now we have somewhere else to put our stuff. George Carlin does a fantastic, not appropriate for church thing on our stuff. A house is just a pile of stuff with a cover on it. And I have my pile and you have yours. But we always want more stuff. The quote that had the $12 billion. That was an industry that didn't exist not that long ago. There were not storage places to store your stuff. Because why would you ever need a place to put your stuff beyond your house? It's a $12 billion now industry. And again, that's an old quote. So, you know, that's more now. One of the other things I've just been struck by this one recently is the more you have, the more it costs to maintain and or use what you have. So it's a silly example, but I think this has been happening. I've just been seeing this a lot recently. You buy a brand new TV. I mean, a really nice one. You've been saving. You can afford it. You found a nice TV. It's going to fit perfectly on the wall. You buy a new TV, which means now you probably need a better cable package. Because if you have a nice TV package, a TV like that, might as well put something on it that's worth seeing. And like, so we get a nicer cable package, which means we need some more hardware because now you have better internet. So and internet's never really gotten to the corner of the house where you need it. So now you need the better. You got to upgrade your wireless system and get that going. And you're gonna need a new DVD player and Blu-ray player because again, you have a nice TV and might as well take advantage of it. Now you need more movies. Probably should pay for Netflix too and some of the other movie services. And again, that's why you need the faster internet. Then you need to make sure you have some security. Because with all that stuff flying around, who knows who can hack into your system. So now we need some more security for our new wireless. And you thought you just bought a TV. And all of a sudden, all of this money's just going. And now that you have all that, you know what you need? A new TV to take advantage of all the other stuff that you've been getting. There's so much, just recently I've been watching different things where we need this and then you need to get insurance for it. You need this and you need to take care of it in some other way. And so there's this danger of you get to certain levels of wealth, a lot, like all of them, you need different wholesale, like you own a house for the first, like I was an apartment guy for a long time, then I got married and got a house, which is awesome. Turns out houses cost a ton of money, and not just the mortgage payment. No. There's so many other pieces of those things. But so much of, like, man, if I had this much more, then I could get that. There's more there. There's more stress there. There's more demands there than just getting that. And then one of the hugest traps, and we'll come back to a couple times, is just debt. Most people in America live in debt, and the ramifications of that are huge. And again, that's a big topic later, so I'm gonna pin it there, and then we'll talk about it later. So from there, that's how lots of the world sees money, and we'll talk more about some of those in a bit. How are we supposed to view money? There's a good Italian proverb that says, the pawn and the king alike, they all go back in the bag. There's a John Ortberg book, which is fantastic. When the game is over, it all goes back in the box. So whether you are a king and queen or you are a pawn, when the game's over, and he kind of starts his book with just Monopoly. And how his grandma taught him how to play, and she always would win, and she would always win, and then one day, he finally beat her. I mean, he had all the hotels, and she was in jail, and finally, she rolled, and it happened on Marvin Gardens, and he cleaned her clock. And then she taught him another lesson. Well done. Now let's put it all back in the box. And he was thinking, no, we're going to leave this out, and we're going to sign it, we're going to date it, we're going to bronze it, we're going to leave it here, because it is a testimony to how wise I am, how good I am, and how I have vanquished you. Except for the reality is, at the end of the game, it all goes back in the box. And that reshapes then how you think. Or it should, at least. It doesn't, but it should. At the end of the game, it all goes back in the box. The possessions, the resume, the body, the money, the pleasures, others' opinions of me, titles, positions, power, health, security. All that, when the game is over, it all goes back in the box. There's a very few things that don't. God doesn't go back in the box. Other people don't go back in the box. And my soul doesn't go back in the box. And then the ironic truth is, and I spend way more of my time, energy, and everything else working on all of the things that go back in the box. So just kind of a reality check. Remember what we're doing here. At the end of the day, the kings and the pawns, they go back in the box. So if we're playing this game of life, how do you not keep score? Or what are the dangerous ways to keep score? One is comparison. And all of these, we all do them. So this isn't a like, oh, I know someone who does this. We all do all of these. Comparison is one of the things to watch out for when you play the game. There's three different kinds of comparison. The first is upward comparison. That person has more than me, which leads to envy very, very quickly. There's lateral comparison, where I'm looking at my neighbors, I'm looking at the people around me being like, okay, like I'm, and competition, and not the good kind. And that one comes back around again in a minute. There's downward comparison. You hang out with people who have less than you, you feel a lot better about yourself, and you become arrogant because I'm doing much better than you all. And so three, there's a danger in comparison. There's a danger in competition. And again, not just comparing ourselves to each other, but actually trying to beat. I need a new whatever because this person has a whatever. They just got a new one of these. I need a newer one, a bigger one, a faster one, a better one. And that feeling of comparison. Or maybe you don't want to win, but you're just that constant nagging of I'm losing. Like, yeah, no, they have better stuff than I do. And again, social media being the obvious, easy example. Competition becomes toxic when it gives rise to envy and jealousy. It becomes dark when I am tempted to cheat in order to come out ahead. It poisons the soul when winner and loser become labels of worth and identity and respect, for the battle itself is lost. One of the other ways not to keep score, and those two are obviously, comparison and competition are related. Some is simply the climbing above. Climbing the ladder, simply always feeling the need for more and being and better and higher, never satisfied until you're at the top of whatever the top is. And with all of these, there's something okay about them, and there's something that's bad and toxic about them. You shouldn't be satisfied. And at the same time, when you start tying your worth into what you have, how well you are climbing the ladder, that's when things start becoming more dangerous than before. So that's some of the different ways that we shouldn't, and yet we do keep score. The follow-up is, how does God keep score? One of the ways that God keeps score is character and soul. John Ortberg, who was kind of doing the climbing up the ladder, said you need to watch out when you're climbing up the ladder, because you may find Jesus and he's climbing down the ladder. Philippians 2 says, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should not look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. One of the strange things about Jesus is, kind of the story of Jesus is, he continually was climbing down the ladder, not up the ladder. So we need to be kind of careful about that, because we're supposed to follow Jesus, and he does strange things sometimes. A guy named, a Yale theologian named Miroslav Volf, says that there are two kinds of richness in life, richness of having and richness of being. Richness of having is an external circumstance. Richness of being is an inner experience. We usually focus on richness of having. We think true happiness lies there. Alas, stuff doesn't belong to me, it doesn't last, it doesn't make us free, it doesn't make me happy, and it doesn't make me secure. Luke 12:21 says, this is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich toward God. There really should be more quote there. You should all read Luke 12 and whatever comes before that, but the idea is the same. Storing up things for yourself, and not being rich toward God, is a problem. The other part of how I would say God keeps score in some ways is, it's a quote that I'll read in a little bit, but just this idea of, at the end of the day, when the game is over, the words you want to hear from God are, well done, good and faithful servant. You did a good job. One of the reasons for that, and one of the ways that we need to kind of think about this, is we need to recognize that everything is God's, everything. First Chronicles 29, yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the majesty and the splendor, for everything in heaven and earth is yours. Yours, O Lord, is the kingdom. You are exalted as head over all. Wealth and honor come from you. You are the ruler of all things. In your hands are strength and power to exalt and give strength to all. Everything is God's, period. We also need to recognize even our abilities come from God. Deuteronomy says, but remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth and so confirms his covenant, which he swore to your forefathers as it is today. And this takes a shift in thinking because I work hard and I get paid and I work hard to get paid. And therefore, it's so easy to think, and therefore what I've worked hard for and my blood and my sweat and my tears gets me this, it's mine. And God says, yeah, but not only was it all mine to begin with, but even that ability that you're touting as your own was also a gift from me. So at the end of the day, and kind of the kind of a lot of the point of this class is it becomes our job to manage well. That if everything is God's, it's our job to manage what God has entrusted to us well. You almost can, I was trying to think of a thought experiment in this, but, and so it's far-fetched, but it may be helpful, I don't know. If you were to, some strange, tragic, horrible example where, like, your house burns down, somehow all, there's a giant, weird, strange computer glitch where they just, all your accounts go to zero. And all your, basically, you lose all your stuff. There's no insurance because that got zeroed out. Like, basically, they lost, the system lost track of you for a minute and your house burns down. Then you're picking back up. Luckily, you know someone with just, well, it's a good friend of yours, and he has just gobs of money. And, coincidentally, a house on your street. And he's like, you know what? I have an extra house. I'm not staying in it. I want you to have it. I want you to enjoy it. I want you to use it. But it's still my house. And I've it's what a coincidence. I have a couple of extra cars and I basically have a lot of some of the same stuff that you have, and I'm gonna let you just use it, and it's yours to use, and I want you to be generous with it, and I want you to use it well, enjoy it. Go. And I wonder, would you use it differently than you're currently using your stuff? Would you be more generous with it? Would you treat it as well or as poorly? We were staying with a friend down in Galveston this summer, and we got there before they did. And their house was decorated. They had a decorator come in, and it was nicer than a house you would bring young children to. Except they invited us, and they have young children, but it was clear that the young children hadn't been there for a long time. And it was this weird, like, this is not ours. And so when one of the kids picks up something glass and goes running across, you're like, well, but no, what's, because you wanted to, we wanted to take care of it better than we wanted to take care of our own stuff, because it's not our stuff. And then they came and their kids were doing the same thing and we felt fine, but it was that feeling of, if I'm borrowing something from someone, I want to treat, I tend to try and treat it better than I treat my own stuff. That might be a clue into how we should live. Part of the challenge, again, is how do we manage God's stuff and God's wealth that he has entrusted to us, given to us, wants us to use, wants us to enjoy, and wants us to be generous with? How do we use it well? How do we make sure we're managing it well? Matthew 25 says, his master replied, well done, good and faithful. This is the parable of the talents. Gives that guy a couple of, a lot of money, less each time. One of them invests it well, and the master replies, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. That is, again, kind of, That would not be a bad thing to hear God say when he welcomes us in. Well done, good and faithful servant. It's all his. We are managers of his stuff. He entrusts it to us to be used well on his behalf. And therefore, it's important for us to manage it well. The Bible doesn't say, you just take everything you have and just hand it to, just give it all away. And also doesn't say just hoard it and save it and just manage it well, tightly. And there's a balance that we have to strike. Jesus told his disciples there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer." So he wants us to manage it well. Luke 16:11 says, "So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches?" That's the latter half that I'm almost to. How then do we manage our wealth well? How do we manage God's wealth well? That's the later topic that we're almost to. The other one, and there was a sermon about this recently, part of what we're supposed to do with God's wealth is to bless the world. Part of it isn't just so we can bless ourselves, but part of it is so that we can use God's wealth to bless others. This was going to be somewhere else, but it works well here. Just one of the things that Chaley and I have been able to do in our marriage, because of how we don't apply enough of the principles I'm about to talk about, but we apply some of them. But by managing it well, every once in a while we are able to be extra generous at different times, and it's fun. Again, it's somewhere later, but it's funny. I really want to find it. It's funny that a lot of people who are stuck in debt, they spend they give about 18% to their credit card company on a pretty regular basis, and they think of themselves as a debtor. If you were to give 18% of your wealth away to charities and stuff, you would be a philanthropist. And it's funny that if you can get yourself on the other side of that debt line, you go from being a debtor to being, and you're still giving away the same dollars. If you're giving away 18% of your wealth on a pretty regular basis, you are an amazing philanthropist. It's the same dollars going out, but one's going to debt and one's going to the charities of your choice. So that's the other piece of, we want to not just use it for us. We want to use it for God's world. This part we're going to do fast, because it was kind of the next part of the Ortberg book, and it applies less and less as we go, but it seems important to kind of get some of these things out. We're playing the game of life. We're trying to keep score well, but therefore we have to play well. You have to roll the dice. You have to take your turn. You have to deal the cards. With more discipline comes more discipline. It's one of the weird truths of life is I find more often than not, if I find one area to be disciplined in, it has ramifications in all the other areas of life. And therefore, if you can get your finances in order, you may find that it helps your diet, it helps your health, it helps all sorts of other areas, because discipline breeds more discipline. It goes the other way too. We need to learn how to play well. Winning alone is called losing. That's not... speaking of couples, that's speaking of community. You can have all the money in the world and no community, and that's a lousy. You did not play well. You can have no money and have good community, and that may be a winner. So be the kind of player that others want to play with. Live generously. Live without regret. I would have loved more deeply. Kind of at the end of the game, you don't want to be saying, "I would have loved more deeply, I would have laughed more often, I would have given more generously, or I would have lived more boldly." Again, that's not playing well. And then one of the other challenges to kind of offset some of those is just finding contentment. Keeping falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, "Who is the Lord?" Or I may become poor and steal and so dishonor the name of my God. That is an amazing proverb. If I have too much, it starts getting really simple to say, because I'm awesome. I have too much because I've invested well and I'm an amazing worker and I'm just amazing. And that's why I have all this cool stuff. And I can leave God completely out of the picture. And the same is true on the other side. And if I don't have enough, I curse God because he took all my stuff, and I don't have enough, and I don't have as much, and all the rest. And somewhere in the middle may be lies the balance. So that's a little bit I'm trying the it'll come up a couple times, but I wasn't kidding in the announcement on Sunday. I don't want this to be a and giving to the church and giving to the church and tithing. So like, I'm really not going to touch tithing. That was it. I'm done. Like, that was as close as I'm going to get to it. It's a huge topic, but I figure you guys hear about it every time stewardship rolls around. So we'll wait till the fall for that. But with that, we kind of turn a little bit then to managing money well. Questions on kind of God's view before we, or just kind of thinking differently about money before we kind of talk about some logistics. All right. So in preparing for this class, I kind of bought like two big stacks of books. One was a ministry study that I know of, and I've had different people go through it, and it changed my life, and oh my gosh, I see money and giving and generosity totally differently. It's a ministry called Crown Ministries, and they have books, and you can do classes, and you can do growth groups, and videos, and all the rest. And some of the resources you will see, I've kind of gleaned from them. I also bought a bunch of Dave Ramsey's books because he's just another one who does the same thing. And again, I know people who he turned my life around. I was, you know, this, and then we worked our way through debt, and now we are debt-free, and now we're working on except for the mortgage, and we're taking a swing on that, too. One of the fascinating things I found from these two very different sources and very different kind of coming at it from different perspectives, their advice from here on out is identical, creepily so. It's as if one of them was just literally copying word for word different parts from one of the, like, Crown, both of them are old, like they've been around for a good couple decades now, so I don't actually know who was first, but, or the other way of looking at it is, or some of this next advice is just universally accepted. And you know, this is where you start. So I kind of picked Crown as kind of I think they called them destinations, but I'm going to call them milestones because destinations seem like a dumb word for what they're talking about here. But there are different milestones that you can get to. Some of you are probably all the way down working on milestone 7 or 6 and 7. Some of you are going to be working on milestone number 1. One of the challenges of pretty much this week as I've been preparing for this class is recognizing we all have different, we all view money differently, we all use money differently, we all have money differently, and we're all in totally different seasons of life as well. Again, my hope is for this whole class, you're just like, yeah, I know all that, and I've done all that, and there's nothing I need to, that would be awesome if you left this class as a waste of time. Congratulations, you're doing better than most people. But therefore, I kind of felt necessary to kind of start at the beginning and kind of work our way through some of these big topics. I'm not going to go through all these. Crown Ministry lends itself a little bit to, while you're digging yourself out of debt, you should be regularly giving to the Lord. Ramsey will be, you should be regularly giving to the Lord. I'm not going to tell you how, like, when that, like, it should start at the beginning, but he's a little bit lighter on that piece. But both of them, we'll talk about budgets in a minute, both of them look at your income as basically how much you bring in minus taxes, minus what you give to the Lord, and then you figure out your expenses next. But they both have a very similar kind of viewpoint from that. I'm not going to read all those milestones because we're going to touch on a couple of them as we go. It's also on in your other packet as well. Step 1, if you haven't done this, this is a good place to start, is this milestone number 1. Build emergency savings is really kind of how you can title it. The first piece that you have to do is work on assessing reality. You have to know where you are before you can figure out how to get where you want to go. So for this next part, you may just need both packets open at once. Page 4 or 5-ish, personal finance statement. Some of you have software, some of you have accountants, some of you have a sticky note at home. You know, some of you can call your bank, whatever it is. But the premise of this first page is find out what assets you have. Find out what liabilities or debts you have. Add those together, subtract it, That's your net worth. But a very simple way of let's make sure we have everything out on the table before we get started. One of the realities of really milestone number one is a lot of people think they're doing better than they are. A lot of people don't know where their money goes. So all of step number one is starting that process of figuring that out. What do you have? The second part of that is then what do you spend money on? Take a month, just write, collect receipts, add the receipts, figure out where your money goes. We spend way more, when we first started doing it, we spend way more on food, and food being the grocery and dining out. And nowadays you can buy almost everything at a grocery store. So like food's a very general topic for us when we budget of it is, you know, you can buy clothes at Sam. I mean, like it's kind of that large category of stuff you buy near a grocery store. How much do you spend there? How much do you not? Again, kind of the tools, your personal finance statement. Where does the money go? Log your spending for a time. One of the, when Chaley, before I met Chaley, she had gone to a financial advisor because someone was like, you should go to a financial advisor. And the financial advisor said, hey, for a month, collect your receipts, bring me the receipts, and I'll figure out where your money goes. And so they did, and they sat down, and like, I'll basically build you a budget based on just your receipts for a month, and we'll just kind of figure that all out. He was then telling her a story of, there was this couple that came in, and they're like, look, we're good money people. We know how much we spend on different categories, and we have it down pretty much to a science. We can't find $10,000. Like, we know how much we make, we know how much we spend, and somehow we're short 10,000, like, somehow we've been spending $10,000 and we don't know where. Like, we can't find it. He's like, collect your receipts, 1 month, bring them in, I'll do the math, I'll kind of lay it out, let me see if I can find it. Okay, but like, it's just gone. Like, we're missing $10,000 every year. He's like, so, they collect their receipts for a month, they bring them in, he, you know, puts them all in the computer, does his thing. They come back. He's like, I found it. They're like, no, like it's $10,000 a year. Where, like, we would know where that is. Like, on your way to work, do you stop by anywhere before you get to work? Well, sure. I mean, I swing by like Starbucks or another thing, and I get a nice coffee in the morning. And like, what about you? When you go to work, what do you do? Like, well, I mean, I'll get a Starbucks and a coffee and a bagel. Like, and I like kind of a nicer coffee. And sometimes in the afternoon, I'll swing by like on the way home. And basically it came out to, they both had very expensive coffees that they liked, often would get snacks every single day. And he's like, that's $10,000. And so there are things like that, where you kind of have to, hey, I can save you a ton of money. Stop. Or don't, but budget it. I mean, that's going to be one of the challenges of budgeting is it's really simple to think, oh, I hate budgeting because if I budget, then I won't be able to use any money. No, budget Starbucks. Like, but make sure you're accounting for it. Make sure it's a choice, not something that just sucks the money out. Like, not something where money goes missing. Partly, step one is really just finding where your money is going and what you have. And then there's a little bit of budget basics. Financial freedom is not determined by how much money you make. It's determined by how you spend what you have. A lot of wealth comes a lot more from what you save, what you don't spend. It's not about making more money. There are countless stories in all the books I've been reading of, I made $40,000 a year, and then I hit it big, sold a record, started making $150,000 a year. And so my expenses went from $40,000 to $150,000, and I took out more debt and other things, and then my salary went back down to $40,000, and my lifestyle was now stuck at a level that was not sustainable. The real trick is how do you keep your expenses low? The second piece of milestone number one, make a budget. Create a budget, recreate a budget, go find your old budget and start there, but make a budget. There's a couple of different pages to help. Variable expenses is one of the challenges, just to help you with weird things. One of the And it'll go with some of my advice, which is don't budget too tight. The goal is not to have a zero at the bottom. Income minus expenses equals what you have left over. The goal isn't zero there. It's positive money, because the reality is stuff comes up. We were just married. We figured out a budget. We're like, that's our budget. And we missed our budget in January because some medical thing came up, and we missed our budget in February because some car thing came up, and we missed it in March because some house thing came up, and we missed it. And I think we got 3/4 through the year before we actually, like, if you missed your budget every single month, like, and it was all, but it was all like good excuse things. I mean, it's one of those, like, If you miss it because something came up, like, what are you going to do? Except it was something came up every single month, every single one. Maybe we need to adjust our budget and leave some more margin there, because apparently in our lives, something comes up every month. So don't budget too tight. But this is the help with some of the weird stuff of, like, we pay some of our insurance once every 6 months. So it's a really big check once every 6 months. So just something to watch for. This will help you with that. Then from there, I switch to that's been Crown Ministry. Dave Ramsey has a really nice, clean monthly cash flow plan. What I liked about his is it also gives you a little bit of a percentages when you actually kind of fill this out. It'll give you a housing. The goal is you're spending between 25 and 35% on housing. If that number is way out of whack, you should think about that, talk about that. Or if your transportation is between 10 and 15%, not 10 or between those numbers, lower is fine always. Higher, that might be somewhere you can cut, should cut, need to cut. But I liked Ramsey's. All the stuff was the same for the most part, but I liked his little percentages near the total. So if you do some division and can figure out your percentages, it'll give you a range of where you probably should be, or what's kind of normal. I'm so far off my page. Percentages. The other thing, just in the interest of tools, it's on your page, but mint.com. It's fantastic. It does budget. It does finances. It's got a lot of bells and whistles. There's a website called You Need a Budget. It's very, very good with budgets. It's not good with anything else. So if you just have a simple, I need to know how much money goes in, how much money comes out, and make sure you're assigning every dollar to a purpose, and it's very simple and easy to use. Personal Capital is another one. It's much more for investing and wealth than it is for budgeting. Quicken's kind of old, but it's just kind of on your computer, but it's nice. It does everything. Then there's a fantastic system called the envelope system. After you have a budget, you go figure out how much you get to spend during the month. You go to the bank, you take that much money out, and you put them in envelopes. You call one envelope food, you call one clothing, you call one whatever you want to call it. And then that, when you're going to the grocery store, you bring the food envelope, and you can spend that much. It's silly and super effective, because you don't. The other advantage to the envelope system is one of the dangers that I think we face is because we don't use cash at all anymore. If I were to buy some of the things I buy with cash, and I would have to pull my wallet out and start dropping 20s down and go, you know what, I don't need that. I will keep it. There's something about that visceral watching money leave my hand, or, you know, I have a briefcase of money that I have to, you know, do. If I have to do that, there's a good chance I'm not buying whatever it is. But if I'm sitting at my computer and I see something I want, and thank God Amazon has a one-click button, I don't even have to see that thing go to a cart. I'm just like, and it just shows up. I think we would spend money differently simply if we were using cash, because it's a different experience to put that money out. So the envelope system's a fantastic one as well. Don't budget too tight. I've already talked. Give yourself some margin there. And the goal here is try to live below your means. Budget conservatively, because stuff comes up. It always does. And then the challenge is, and then monitor your progress. It doesn't do you any good if it doesn't actually change your behavior. Just knowing that you overspend your budget every single month keeps you well in debt. The goal is, hey, we've been over every month. We need to change something now. Maybe we shouldn't be spending that much on these topics. So you have to monitor it to see those things. One of the things, this sounds goofy, and my wife and I are nerdy, so that's just, we're okay with that. Other people will think it's funny. We've done it once, and we'll do it more because it was fantastic. But we had a what should be a quarterly lunch date, but basically I met her at lunch, and I had printed out all our finances and all our budget and our finances and where we were and some of the goals that I had and the calendar, and she printed out some of that stuff as well. And then we had a, where I heard this, they did a, it was a, they did that at 4, and then it turned into a dinner and drinking date later. Ours was a lunch date, but it was basically an opportunity to actually, like, there was manila folders and there was, you know, and talk, but it was a chance to talk through, wait, why is, I thought we were saving more over here. I thought we were doing more over here. Wait, why aren't we, wait, isn't this our goal? Why are we spending so much here and here and here? And it was a chance to try and change behavior before the end of the year, when you're like, hey, we lost a lot of money that year. That was a bad year. But it was a way to kind of have those conversations, to talk through, this is where our money is. This is what our money's doing. This is what it's not doing. Maybe this is what it should be doing. These are some of our goals for the year and tracking them. So you should do it more than that. We've done one of them. It was fantastic. I highly recommend it. Your coworkers will make fun of you, and they'll be jealous. That's all you need to know. They'll be like, "That's you guys are silly. We should do that." So at the end of all of that, everyone was very consistent. If you are well in debt, if you have no money in your savings, if you have none of those things, step one, your first major goal after kind of getting a budget and figuring out where you spend is you need to put $1,000 somewhere in savings, somewhere where you won't spend it easily. $1,000 needs to go in savings. And the premise is you will never dig yourself out of debt. You will never dig yourself out of any hole if you don't have a little bit of margin to work with, because you start digging yourself out of debt and you're doing a really good job, and then your tires go flat and you need new tires for your car, and suddenly there goes $500, and now you don't have it, so you have to go into debt and you're worse off than where you were before. So step one is leave off the find a way to put $1,000 in the bank. Don't drink coffee for, you know, whatever, or just water, whatever it is, but get that there first. My assumption is there's part of that one, for most people in the room, finding a budget or redoing your budget or finding a way to monitor your budget are the big takeaways there. But if you don't have $1,000 somewhere, that's step one. Milestone 2 and 3, I'm putting lots of them together here. Everyone's very, very consistent. Get out of debt. In order to get out of debt, you have to quit borrowing money. So it is more challenging for some than others. The danger, too, is the deeper you are in debt, the harder it is to get out of debt. There's a super vicious cycle here. This is one of two times I'm actually going to do some numbers, but it was a fun little example that I found in a book and frightening. If you owe $5,000 for your credit card and you pay 18% interest rate on that, you're basically paying $1,000 a year, which is not all that abnormal. You're paying $1,000 in interest. That's $5,000 this year, or $5,000 in 5 years, that's $40,000 in 4 years. If you were to, instead of giving the credit card company $1,000, if you were to use that and invest that, and I think this is it's Ramsey because it's 12%. And you could find somewhere where you can make 12%. And if you can, you should let me know, because that's the book was written a long time ago when that was possible. Historically, if you put money in the stock market 100 years ago, you're probably making 12%. So historically, we'll give him some points back, sure. I don't know if that's the new reality, but that's a different issue. But if you were to find an amazing thing like that and get 12% back, by the end of 5 years, you would have $6,000. And at the end of the 40, you would have $767. So instead of just paying interest payments to your credit card, if you were to put that in an investment, you would have $700,000 in 40 years instead of breaking even. Interestingly, and this is important to remember, the credit card company, they're getting $1,000 from you every year. They're investing it, if they're happy and it's working the way it's supposed to, they're investing that at about 18%, which means at the end of 40 years, they will have $4 million from your $1,000 every year invested at 18%. There's a reason why credit card companies come in big buildings. There's a reason why they have lots of money. They have our money. My stepmom worked at Visa for a long time. So this is the reality. It's helpful to remember that debt is a product. It's something that makes people lots of money. Similar to if you're good at math, you should have trouble going to Vegas. Simply because if you can build a city in the middle of a desert, you have lots of someone else's money. This is one of those areas where, like, credit cards are a great tool, but there's a really huge danger on the other end, and some people are making lots of money because of it. So just being aware of that. Another example, same kind of idea though. The average person has a car payment of about $500 a month for about 64 months. Most people buy a new car when the old one gets paid off. Why? Because we need a new car. Do you need a new car? Maybe. For most people, you are paying a car payment for all of your working life. If you were to invest that same $500 a month, and again, averaging 12%, you'd have almost $6 million by the age of 65. So just your working life, $500 a month into an amazing investment. Instead of having a new car every time you pay it off, you'd be a $6 million per kind of, you'd be a millionaire. So just another one of those examples of debt is scary. It's making someone money and not necessarily you. The other reason, some other costs and dangers of debt, it adds stress, it adds fear. What happens if we can't make our payments? You have less control of your life because you have to pay the debtor or lose your whatever. There's a biblical view of debt, sort of. I think there's a nuance here. We'll get to it. But it's all the way at the end, or it's in here somewhere. But this is fascinating. The Israelites are coming out of Egypt. They're on their way into the promised land, and God's giving them a little bit of do's and don'ts. Don't eat the thing with the cow, and don't do the thing with the and all these do's and don'ts. And in the process of, if you follow the Lord and do what you're supposed to do, you will be blessed. And he says, however, there should be no poor among you, for in the land of the Lord your God is giving you to possess as your inheritance, he will richly bless you. If only you fully obey the Lord your God and are careful to follow all these commands I am giving you today. For the Lord your God will bless you as he has promised, and you will lend to many nations, but will borrow from none. You will rule over many nations, but none will rule over you. There's a weird little line there about when you're prospering and doing well and following the Lord, you will be able to lend, you won't need to borrow. Deuteronomy goes on. Moses was this kind of guy. And if you don't follow the Lord, if you aren't doing it, he writes, the alien who lives among you will rise above you higher and higher, but you will sink lower and lower. He will lend to you, but you will not lend to him. He will be the head and you will be the tail. All these curses will come upon you. They will pursue you and overtake you until you are destroyed because you did not obey the Lord your God and observe the commands and decrees he gave you. And just to kind of sum up, Proverbs 22:7, the rich rule over the poor and the borrower is servant to the lender. I lean to the debt is dangerous category. When the people are following the Lord and are blessed, they won't need to borrow. When the people are not following the Lord, they will end up in debt and they will sink lower and lower. Now, the one added disclaimer is I think our world has changed to a point where it is difficult, if not impossible, to, if nothing else, buy a house these days without debt. When my parents were growing up, when they bought their first house, it was $10,000, $6,000, $10,000. I mean, it was in the tens of thousands of dollars in California to buy a nice house with a couple of bedrooms in a nice part of town. That house would now be worth $2 to $3 million, I want to say. And, you know, inflation hasn't quite, and it's California, but inflation hasn't gone up that much. But home prices have. So the world has changed since, so I don't know that you can, I would still add, debt is very, very dangerous. If you ever see one of those debt calculators of a 30-year mortgage, here's how much you're paying in interest, it makes you want to puke, that you're paying almost twice, you're almost buying your house a second time. For the permission to borrow someone else's money. So we're not supposed to like it. You're allowed to use it if you're careful, but try and stay away from it. A lot of the, I think Ramsey is famous for the go home, take your credit cards, cut it. Just cut it in half, don't use it. Use a debit card where it has to be the money you already have that you can use. I know Ramsey's a big fan of just cut them. Don't get yourself farther in debt. One of the tools is in here somewhere. I think it's back a page, back a couple pages. Your debt list. If you do have credit card debt and a student loan and car payments and a mortgage and some other ones, it's not a bad exercise. Write it down. Figure out what you're paying. Have it all in one place. Figure out what the interest rates are. A good finance person would tell you find the one that has the highest interest rate and pay that down first. Ramsey and others would say find the one you can pay off the fastest and get a win under your just find the smallest one, and we're going to knock that one out first. And when you knock that one out, find the next one, the next biggest one, and knock that one out next. It's not the best finance-wise. It is the best psychology-wise. If the biggest loan you have is the one that has the highest interest rate, you'll be chomping away at that thing, and at some point you'll say, screw it. Let's just go. Who needs a budget? We'll just go live. So psychology-wise, it is best to find the smallest one, knock it out, work on the next one. They call it, it's in a couple places, even in this paperwork, in a lot of those sources. Both of them refer to it. This is one of those places where someone's copying someone here. But they both call it the snowball effect of if you can pay, once you pay off one of those, you keep paying at the same rate and you start paying the other one and you get more money each time to keep paying as those debts start disappearing. So you actually can speed up how you're paying those things down. And it's just the way finances work. But debt is dangerous. No, debt tool, goal. So goal number one, it's milestone number two. Number two is pay off your credit cards because those tend to have the highest interest rate. Milestone number three is then start working through the bigger ones. Within this step, you're going to take that $1,000 that you've already saved as your kind of your emergency fund, and you're going to start making that bigger. The goal of an emergency fund is you should have between 3 and 6 months worth of expenses somewhere where it's not invested and it can't go up or down and it's decently safe and you can get at it. And again, people lose their jobs. People have medical things happen. There are different, your ACs go out. All manner of different things can happen, and suddenly you find yourself needing, you're getting rid of your debt, and you're doing the thing, and you've got your budget, and you're working through it, and all of a sudden something happens, and it puts you all the way back to square one, unless you can cinch up the belt for a time, start saving, and getting a good, healthy emergency fund. If you have a very variable job, you may lean toward that 6 month number or beyond. If you have a pretty stable job and a stable industry, 3 months. I know when we were first getting married and I was getting my entree into the petroleum industry, some of the advice that Chaley had received on coming into that industry is, number one, you should have a year's worth of salary in cash. Because the way that industry has always worked is when times are good, they're very good. When times are bad, you will get fired within your working life at least once or twice just because the company goes bankrupt. If you're in, and the other part of the advice was, and marry a teacher, someone who can work anywhere and always get something. So she was close, but depending on the variability of life, 3 months minimum, again, cash or something that won't fluctuate. If the stock market were to go to zero tomorrow, which would obviously have some larger ramifications, that's not where you want your emergency fund. You don't want it in bonds where you can't get the money back out again. You need it in something relatively liquid, which sucks because it's not doing anything for you, but it's there for a rainy day, and rainy days come. Pay off your debt, have a healthy emergency fund. That's milestone 2 and 3. Those ones are important. Questions on those? We're kind of coming into a landing, not quite. We got a couple more. We good? Okay. Milestone 4, 5, and 6. At some point, I didn't really have much to say. They kind of are self-explanatory. But adjust your... So now you're getting yourself out of debt. You're starting to see the light. You're kind of breathing a little bit more clearly. You got your emergency fund that's starting to be significant enough that you have a little bit more breathing room there as well. Now we start kind of digging into some of these other things. So you may want to rebudget a little bit. Frankly, if you have cinched your belt tighter to get yourself to this state, you may not want to loosen it too much because you actually got some good momentum here and you can actually get some of these savings in place. But you may want to recreate some new goals. Talk about what you want to do, start saving for the future, invest wisely, and all the rest. So adjust your budget, monitor spending, blah, 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 blah. One of the craziest things about finances is called compounding. And it's basically there's an exponential nature of finances. If you do it right, and again, if you can make 12%, that's fantastic. But this was somewhere in a book, and it was amazing. And I got it wrong. But Ben, age 19, invests $2,000 a year at 12% for 8 years, so till he gets to 26. Then he stops, leaves the money in that same investment, doesn't touch it till he's 65. Arthur, age 27, so he's going to start when Ben was done. He puts $2,000 every single year into the same investment thing at 12% until he's 65. Who has more money when they get to 65? Here's a hint. Ben put in, I did the math here, $16,000 total. Then he was done. Arthur put in $78,000 over the course of his life. Who has more? The slacker, Ben, has $2.2 million. Arthur has $1.5 million. So overall, they're both doing just fine. If you can keep, again, if you can keep money in something like this for a long time, it will help. But Ben has almost an extra $1 million by investing a lot early and leaving it. Now, had Ben started doing $2,000 at age 19 and kept it going, he would have like double that, and that's a different, but just... With all this, like, this is the annoying part of all this is absolutely dig yourself out of, the best thing you can do is dig yourself out of debt, because that will bite you faster than anything else. The frustrating part is, man, if you could get some money invested as well, that may help you long term. But debt will, getting out from interest payments will help you faster than investing, especially, and at the current rates, getting out of debt will help you way faster than investing in some of these things. One of the challenges is simply diversification. It was a funny Ecclesiastes is one of the few books I actually studied in seminary. But there's this weird little verse that says, give portions to seven, yes to eight, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. Basically, it's you don't put all your eggs in one basket. That's kind of where that comes from, is this weird verse in Ecclesiastes. But put things in different places, because different places will disappear. Different things will happen over the course of your life. And a little bit of diversity is not a bad thing. One of the challenges, one of the other ones, maintain. Again, the theme is managing God's resources well. So we've got a plan. We're getting out of debt. We're saving well for the future now, trying to open up opportunities for what God may call us to do in the future. We are now living a more generous life because we're not giving to Visa anymore. We're now giving to wherever we want. One of the challenges is, and again, a lot of this, there's a balance between getting more, having more, and using more, and keeping what you have and keeping it safe and saving more, getting yourself out from different challenges. So one of the challenges, like both, all the sources kind of spend a good chapters talking about make sure you have health insurance, make sure you have home insurance, make sure you have some form of life insurance. All of them were not big fans of whole life. Insurance is one of the topics I know nothing about, but they all went to great pains of saying whole life's a horrible, horrible instrument. Don't get it. Term life was the one they kind of liked. I don't know. That's what they said. I think it's you don't get as much back later. But I don't know. I skipped those chapters. I don't know anything about insurance. But be aware of those things. Either way, insurance is better than not. Because things happen. But that was a piece there. There's a strange irony in the fact that you can give 18% to your credit card and you're both average and a debtor, and you can give that same 18% to a charity and you are a philanthropist. And it's the same dollars leaving your house, just for different causes. Then the last, milestone seven, and this is another one that this one's an important one. I think a lot of us do really poor jobs here. Leave a legacy, estate planning. Do you have a will? If you don't have a will, you should get a will. This was a quote in one of the books. I don't want to get a will because then I'm going to die. You will die. Go get a will. It's kind of one of those certainties of life. So, I didn't write that stat down, but it was 60 to 70% of people die without an updated will. Some just extraordinary number. So, that's a good project. Go make sure you have one. And then almost more than a will, I found this to be super helpful. I added a whole extra piece to it. The last two pages. It's one thing if you know everything you need to know about your will and your testament and your estate. But if you're the one who dies, that's not a helpful place to put it. This would not be a bad form, this one and the next one, to have somewhere where someone could find it. Here's where my trust is, or will is located. Here's who's supposed to do this, that, or the other thing. Here are some benefits that you should be looking for and hopefully finding. Here's some life insurance coverage. Here's the policy number. It's all in one place, as opposed to I have a strange job where I hear nightmare stories of so-and-so died, and I've been digging through their desk and filing system, I think it was my grandma left money just in books, and all sorts of other things like that. This would be awesome. Family information, military service history, funeral instructions. The more you can write that stuff down, and you know it can be changed. You don't care; you'll be gone then. But if people could have that, that'd be amazing. I'm trying to think if I have one right now. I don't know that I do. I have in the history of my being a pastor had folders in my drawer that says so and so's funeral and so and so's still alive. But they basically like I want this song. I want this song. I want to hear this verse, and I don't want my family to have to figure that stuff out. Again, one of the things that people harped on was you should absolutely go to a funeral home and get it all planned. Don't prepay. And the example was because if you could take that prepaid money and put it in an investment for 12%, you would have $700,000 by the time you go, as opposed to not having to pay for a casket. Again, that's what it said. I don't know. You will die, 100% certainty. So therefore, some of the stuff we could probably plan. This, I cleaned up a, Chelly had a coworker whose mother was, it's coming in for a landing, I think I'll say. But either she made her mother do this or her mother just did this on her own. But just getting the information that's not on the pretty one, who are your emergency contacts? What is your insurance information? The back is where it starts getting super helpful. Blood type, immunization records, medical allergies, illnesses, operations, doctors, medications, medical history, financial institutions and accounts. It says it in red, don't email this, don't digitize this, because if someone got a hold of this and you filled it out well, they could liquidate you. Oh my gosh, what an amazing tool that would be if someone goes into a hospital and I don't actually know what medications they're on and I don't know who their doctors are and I don't know what they want or anything else. Again, it wouldn't be bad to just have that somewhere just in case. But trying to, again, the topic's management. The topic is stewardship. How do I steward my life and the resources God has entrusted to me well? It would not be good stewardship to be like, I've managed it well all my life, and then, you know what, when I'm dead, I don't care. You guys just fight over it. I watched in my family, like, my dad's side, they all fought over the inheritance all of the living memory of my grandparents' life, and they were all lawyers, so when Grandma and Grandpa finally did pass away, there was at least one or two lawsuits that then happened with brothers and sisters. How much better if it had been clearer, and it was clear because Grandpa was a lawyer too, but that's a different story. But make it easy. Manage well, and manage well doesn't mean I did it well to a point and then I got lazy. You manage to the end. Tell a good story, and then part of it, and I think this is part of God's thing with our management of it . When you manage it well, you can be generous. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. One of my favorite things about managing money well is it makes it easier to be generous. If I'm in debt, if I'm worried, if I'm stressed, if I don't have enough, if I feel just always like there's not enough, it's hard to lighten my fist up a little bit and say, you can have this, you can use this. And I think this is one of the things that it really, good management of these things frees us to be generous, to use these things as we want, and as hopefully God wants. So that's part of the ultimate goal. I just kind of looked up a couple of just random rules of thumb, I think all of these are kind of interesting. You should be saving about 10 to 15% of your income toward retirement. That's not a bad number. Insurance coverage, you should have 5 times your gross salary in coverage. Obviously, you want more stocks at the beginning of your working life. You want more bonds or things that won't be so volatile later. And in retirement, you're not supposed to withdraw more than 4% a year, and you should be A-okay. But those are just freebies. I don't know. I literally looked up a fun. I thought there would be more and they would be better. There weren't. But the internet kind of let me down on that one. But whatever. Questions? Comments? Bless you twice.
Is there any I know for some cases where beneficiary know what is in here and they kind of hasten your life.
The question is there any advice of letting beneficiaries know what's in the will before beforehand? Because one of them may be the one who determines whether they pull the plug or not. And yeah, no, there wasn't. Their thing is have a will. Be prepared. It's less of a, for the most part, all of them do a decent job of not telling this is how you should do it or all the rest. It's more make sure you are aware and make sure they know, make sure that information's available. But no, I don't know that it is. And I'd say, because I watched this play itself out in my family of they knew grandfather had some money, and therefore it was an unhealthy family for a long amount of time because they were all waiting for grandma and grandpa to go. Not, again, we got lots of issues, and it goes all through. But. Yeah, but I'm winning. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, yeah. No, I would say it's not healthy. My view of a lot of things like inheritances and bonuses and all the rest is the goal is to budget as if none of that's happening. The goal is to not be counting on any of that stuff and to assume. There is no inheritance, assume there is no bonus, assume there is no extra special something money coming at any time. And budget accordingly. And then when one of those things does come, now I can be free and generous and I can fill up, you know, what are my financial goals? And oh my gosh, I can knock that one out right now. But to budget accordingly, budget as if something is coming is a dangerous thing. You could live to 120, if they're waiting for a big paycheck, they'll be retired by the time that big paycheck's on its way. And so I don't think anyone needs to know what the inheritance is, but make sure you have someone who knows. Make sure that's written down somewhere, though. So other questions or comments?
Mm-hmm. Right? Which that's, I mean, like, that tells me I've got a lot to do because I don't have any of that information. Mm-hmm. Kind of where it borders on the strange part is Lisa's folks literally have their tombstone purchased and installed with their names on it.
Uh-huh.
And their born dates, just not their death dates. So they've kind of taken it to a strange
Yeah.
thing.
Yeah. No. And at different stages of life, some of those things aren't like, that's what we do. When we're 110 years old, like it's not something you like. If you shouldn't all go buy a plot right now. Like that's, but you all should have a will. And there's a balance of there are certain seasons where like, yeah, no, at some point you should have a binder. I don't know that you need like at this point the kids can dig through the crap because dag nabbit, that's you know. But it's the horror story. Like, the binder's the extreme version. The horror story is like I had a house full of stuff and papers were everywhere and simply I want to say the Bargers were part of it. Like I've heard horror stories from the Bargers of like there were like just finding the financial institutions. Like there was no just find like, because you can't leave. You're like there may be a ton of money sitting somewhere that's not written down anywhere. How do you like, and you're grieving, so you don't want to be like, money, like, where do I find it? Except, like, you don't want to leave grandma and grandpa's money just laying somewhere that's, you know, so that's the balance is as you hit different, like, a will is important, and then as you hit different life stages, you should work on some of these, like, because as weird as it is that your parents have a headstone, what a blessing that you have a binder. Of I don't have to think so hard when the horrible happens. So I think there's a balance there. You don't want to creep your kids out, but being prepared isn't bad either. Other questions or comments? Yes.
Yeah, Mm-hmm. It was even late for us. We had probably our two girls who had just gotten out of college.
Around there.
We concentrated on the debt reduction, and we financed two college educations, juggling credit card debt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a and before you've liberated yourself from it, it's a stressful way to live. And the Bible doesn't say you can't; it just says be super careful. And because stuff will come up, that's the piece. Is stuff happens? Sure. It's the I'll be able to pay it back this month, so I'll be fine. Unless something else happens, and then you can't, and then you're even farther in the hole. Chaley and I saw a segment on the paycheck, the cash, turning your pay stub or whatever, and the payday loan stuff, and the horror stories there, and the stat, and I can't believe this is true. There are more payday loan places than there are McDonald's in the United States. Let that sink in for a minute, because there's a McDonald's on it, but. But the reason they're there is because they're making money. The reason they're making money is because it's not a deal. Because you don't actually. I just need a little bit for a short time, then I'll pay it back. No, you won't. Like, not if anything happens at all. And once you get in a little bit, you can't get out. So be careful. Other questions or comments? Yeah. Yeah. No. The cool part of all, I have now two stacks of books, so if you want to borrow one, more power to you. But the cool part about the books is there are story after story after story of someone who makes, like me and my wife, we make $20,000 a year, we were $80,000 in debt. Or just these extraordinary stories, and we started working on it. And then we got rid of one, and then we got rid of another, and then we got rid of another, and then then we were off to the races a little, because then we kept that lifestyle, and we kept going, and now we have X amount saved, whereas before we were in the hole. And there's just story after story of different people that, like, you got to dig in. There's going to be, a lot of ramen in your future or whatever it is, but you can. And the flip side is, and if you're doing well, budget well. I mean, the other side of the story is budgets aren't bad, because then I won't be able to have any fun. And like, I can't go out to eat, I can't go out to eat lunch or anything like that. No, budget for it. Just make it intentional and not accidental. All right. With that, I'm going to say, here's your packet. If you need, these are all, I have all these digital. So if you want the digital version, let me know, and I can just email you whatever parts of this you want. This packet was the weird one of, for some people, they don't need that page or that page or that page or that page, and they need just that last one or the first one. So it's a more packet than you probably need. I would encourage and commend to you page one. What are your short-term financial goals, and what are your long-term financial goals? And then what are a couple of next steps? This is a good thing to do. If you are married, short-term and long-term goals, getting on the same page about those is huge. Normally in a marriage, someone looks at the numbers and someone doesn't look at the numbers, just because you have to separate duties and that's just the way of it. I can budget all day long, and if I'm not the only one writing checks, it's not going to work. And the more you can have similar goals, Chaley and I are working to save towards something, and it's brought both us together and brought a lot of other things in line, because our goals are now similar, as opposed to when we first got married. I'm saving for this. When I do it with premarital counseling, and I'm like, hey, what are your short-term, long-term goals? They tend to be different. I'm like, okay, good that we both wrote them down. Now we have 6 short-term goals and 6 long-term goals, but let's start. How do we start working on these? Talk about those. Talk about the budgeting. Talk about what we're trying to do together. And then what are the next steps to do it? With that, I'm going to pray, and then I'll send you on your way. Lord God, we thank you that you have entrusted to us all that you have, all the opportunities you've given us, all the history you've given us, all the blessings you've given us. Lord, we thank you for the good of the system, the good of we can do work and get paid, that we can invest money, that we can buy things we need. Lord, there are so many people in this world right now that can't get running water, and they don't know where their next meal is coming from. We thank you that so many of those blessings aren't fears for us. That said, Lord, we also acknowledge that many, even in our midst and throughout this area, live in crippling amounts of debt and live in crippling amounts of fear and stress because of finances. Lord, we pray that we would, even today, take whatever the next step is, that you would help us assess where we are, figure out where to go, what our goals are, and work together to accomplish them, that we might manage the resources you have entrusted to us well. Lord, help us take the time. Help us find the time. Lord, help us work at being good stewards of all you've blessed us with. Lord, we pray these things in the strong name of Jesus the Christ. Amen. Thank you all for coming.